that may help treat or prevent autism and other human neurological disorders in which social reciprocity is impaired. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. I'm Yael Cassander.
Our goal is to alleviate hunger in 14 counties in eastern Illinois. In those 14 counties, right now we're serving about 45,000 people per month. There's really new people coming saying, I don't know why I'm here. I've got a job. I ought to be able to feed my family, but I can't. We had been working with WILL on looking at the impact of the changes in the economy here in our community. And that has opened up a lot of doors for us to be able to talk to more people about what we're seeing going on and making better linkages in the communities that we serve. I used to think of it as, I listen to WILL, and now it's like, but wait, WILL listens to us too. That's a very different relationship, a more exciting relationship for us. I'm Andrea Rundell, and I work for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, and WILL is my source for community connections.
It's 2:41. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. After rallying across the South last week, African-American farmers were to be in Washington, D.C. today to call on the government to pay up on its more than 10-year-old promise to compensate for past discrimination by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Despite the conditions of the 1999 civil rights settlement, more than 70,000 African-American farmers have yet to see a dime. Julie Rose of WFAE of Charlotte, North Carolina, has more.
Vern Schweitzer is 63 years old, but he still single-handedly farms 19 acres along a busy country road just outside Winston-Salem.
And I got strawberries here. They don't look that great right now, but I say in another 30 days, you wouldn't believe how they would be looking.
Those sell good at the farmer's market?
Lord, yeah.
Schweitzer leans into the wind and crunches over the frozen ground. Collard greens and onions are peeking up through the snow.
We'll take a shortcut.
Schweitzer's one of only about 30,000 black farmers in America today. They're mostly in the South and represent just 1.5% of total farm operators in America, compared to 14% back in 1920.
You're kind of a dying breed, aren't you?
Oh, definitely. And this is why you cannot get any more young black farmers in it, because they see the struggle that older black farmers got, being discriminated and mistreated. Why would you want to get into something like that?
After 30 years of farming, Schweitzer hoped he'd own 100 acres and spend most of his time teaching kids to farm. Instead, he owns just a fraction of that, and he blames the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Time and again, Schweitzer says USDA officials gave him the runaround, delaying and denying his loan requests. They said he didn't meet the standard for a government loan.
And it's the same standard for everybody, they say. But that's a lie, too. I know farmers, white farmers, that can get a loan quick, fast, and in a hurry.
In 1999, the USDA settled a class action lawsuit admitting to decades of discrimination against black farmers. Some 15,000 of those farmers managed to navigate the legal paperwork for an average settlement of $50,000. Many, like Vern Schweitzer, were rejected because they didn't have the right documentation or didn't hear about the settlement and applied late. They're still waiting to be paid.
There was a real wrong that was done here by the government.
John Boyd founded the National Black Farmers Association to fight for that money.
There's been a mission of guilt. There's been study after study. Secretary after secretary has come and gone. And the black farmers still ain't got their money.
In 2008, Boyd helped convince Congress to give those 70,000 late-filing farmers a chance at the settlement. President Obama put more than $1 billion in his budget last year to help pay them. Congress cut it. This year, he's included it again, and White House spokesman Robert Gibbs said,
ensuring that justice is done is important in this situation.
The primary issue now, I think, is just that there's not money appropriated to pay the successful claimant.
That's North Carolina Democrat Mel Watt, a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, also lobbying for the settlement funding. But there's talk of a spending freeze, and the farmers may have to wait for the economy to improve to get their money. John Boyd says they don't have time.
The average age of a black farmer is 60, and many have died, you know, waiting and thought that they would get justice from the government and all of the promises that were made for decades.
U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has said it's finally time to close this unfortunate chapter. The black farmers who rally in Washington today are taking him at his word. For NPR News, I'm Julie Rose in Charlotte.
A big biography is due to hit store shelves this spring. In this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News, commentator Amy Guida ponders whether its sources could have violated key employment contract provisions.
On April 13, 2010, I can fairly easily predict what book will be among the first you'll see when you enter a bookstore. That's because on April 13, 2010, Kitty Kelly's biography on Oprah Winfrey will be released. Crown Publishers promises a 544-page book based on the 850 interviews Kelly conducted over 3 years. The company suggested somewhat tantalizingly in a news release that readers will be both fascinated and newly informed by the detailed and well-rounded biography. Oprah likely won't be in a particularly good mood on April 13th because she does her best to keep her life private. I say this with some authority because Oprah played a role in a related lawsuit a decade or so ago, and an Illinois appellate court back then sided with the television talk show host, deciding that those confidentiality agreements that Oprah had her employees sign were absolutely enforceable. Confidentiality agreements like the promise to keep your mouth shut during employment and in the years following employment. Back then, and likely today as well, Oprah asked her employees and employees-to-be to sign a contract agreeing that they were, quote, obligated to keep confidential and never disclose or confirm or deny the veracity of any statement or comment concerning Oprah Winfrey or any of her confidential information. The precise language regarding the length of the contract, during the worker's employment or business relationship, and thereafter, which by definition would include the past 3 years of Kitty Kelly's interviews. Now, it's possible that all employees and former employees stuck to the contract and refused to leak information themselves or confirm or deny anyone else's leaks. But if not, and if the employees sung like canaries, Oprah's attorneys will at the very least dust off that court decision. In it, a former producer for Oprah brought a lawsuit against Harpo Incorporated, which is Oprah's company. The producer alleged that the confidentiality agreement she signed was too restrictive, given that basically she wouldn't be able to say anything to anyone at any time, and that she was a journalist who wanted to write about her experiences, information she characterized as matters of legitimate public interest and concern. The court recognized that the contract itself was restrictive, but not to the breaking point. Oprah, the court wrote, did not seek to restrain the plaintiff's future career or to limit the type of work that the plaintiff might do. Instead, the court wrote, the confidentiality agreement simply restricted the plaintiff's ability to disseminate confidential information that she obtained or learned while an Oprah employee. Ultimately, to again quote the court, the confidentiality agreement was both reasonable and enforceable. According to a history website, April 13th also marked the day that somebody on Apollo 13 told Houston that they had a problem. And the Beatles recorded the hit single, Help. Those events have some relevance for any Oprah employee who dared speak to Kitty Kelly. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois. Maria Callas defined what it meant to be a diva. She remains one of the towering figures of opera. Exciting as Callas was as a performer, her voice began to decline while she was still relatively young. Experts and fans alike continue to question what happened to a voice that was both exhilarating and controversial.
The year was 1952. Maria Callas was performing what would become one of her legendary roles, Norma, at London's Covent Garden. Opera critic John Steen was in the audience. Steen says there were high expectations about Callas's appearance, but what he remembers vividly was the opera's most challenging aria, Casta Diva, and the feeling he had that Callas might not hit the highest notes.
You felt that any miscalculation, just the tiniest degree of miscalculation, the thread might break, disaster might come. Now, it didn't happen, but there was a certain tension in the air.
Thank you.
Just a few years earlier in Venice, Callas had stunned the opera world with the extraordinary range of her voice. She was performing Brunhilde in Wagner's Die Walküre, a heavy, challenging role that played to her strengths. Then on very short notice, she was asked to step into the part of Elvira in I Puritani. James Jordan, editor of ParterreBox.com, says no one thought a dramatic soprano like Callas could sing the role of Elvira.
It showed off an extremely high range. It also showed an ability to sing coloratura, which is a fast, fluid way of singing music that is ordinarily not that easy for the more dramatic singers. So people were looking and saying, she's the most astonishing singer anyone has ever heard of, and yet no one had ever heard of her.
Callas's ability to sing such a wide range of roles was one of the things that led to her meteoric rise. But critic Conrad Osborne believes it also contained the seeds of her vocal decline. Callas's voice was already starting to fail her by the time she was in her 40s, quite young for an opera singer. A number of factors, including a rapid loss of weight, may explain why. But Osborne, who also teaches voice, believes Callas lacked the proper technique to sustain her ambitious repertoire.
It's very unusual to combine those two ways of singing and to extend the range over that wide a compass. And if your technique, your structural technique I'm talking about, the way the voice is balanced and structured so that when you throw a lot of energy into it, the way an athlete does or a dancer, the coordinations that respond are balanced and efficient. If that isn't true all the way up and down that very wide range, then you're inviting some trouble.
For Callas fans like James Jordan, the singer more than made up for her vocal flaws with her talent for bringing the music to life. Her imperfections set her apart, and her ability to find the emotional meaning in a role was unsurpassed.
One thing about her voice that made it so striking was that it was unlike anyone else's, that sometimes it had sort of a hollow sound, sometimes a very dark sound, sometimes a little shrill on top. So it was an extremely distinctive voice. More important than that, I think, was what she did with the voice, how she used the voice as an expressive instrument.
Callas, as USC professor Tim Page, brought daring back to opera. She challenged her audience and never bored them.
The thing about Callas was that there was always a keen dramatic intelligence and a real sense of real harrowing intensity to her singing, which I think made her extremely special. I mean, when you listen to Callas, even after her voice had started to go, it still tends to be an unforgettable musical experience.
Page points to Callas' performance in Carmen late in her career as an example of the kind of emotional depth she brought to a role.
She really is the raw, untamed gypsy girl. There is just a ferocity and an intensity here, which you're not really used to from a lot of the recordings of it beforehand, which would concentrate only on nice melodies, prettily sung. Callas' Carmen was not necessarily very pretty, but it was thrilling.
What makes Callas' voice so distinctive, says James Jordan, is its complexity. Like any great art, Jordan says, one wants to keep coming back to her performances over and over again.
With Callas' singing, even hearing three or four notes strung together, you hear, oh, I didn't hear how she did that before. That's so beautiful to take just these few simple notes and to go from this note to that note in such an elegant and graceful way shows so much and means so much. And so every time you listen, you hear something a little different. You hear something a little more sophisticated.
When Jordan was a teenager, Collis did her last tour. It was not well received, but looking back on it now, Jordan says he regrets not having made the effort to see her, because after all, there will never be another Collis. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Earth and Sky.
Today, Carol Greider, a molecular biologist at the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, along with two collaborators, Greider won the 2009 Nobel Prize in Medicine for her work on chromosomes.
Chromosomes are where all of the DNA is in the cell that gives the instructions for all the processes that the cells have to carry out. The chromosome is duplicated every time the cell has to divide.
And cell division is what keeps our bodies healthy and growing. Greider explained that when cells divide, a little material gets sheared off the ends of the chromosomes. About two decades ago, Greider figured out that an enzyme called telomerase is what prevents our chromosomes from becoming smaller and smaller.
The telomerase is an enzyme, sort of like a little machine inside the cell. It balances out the shortening that occurs during cell division.
If cells get too short, she said, they stop dividing altogether. Since her initial discovery of this enzyme, medical applications for it have been found, for example, in helping stop the runaway cell growth associated with cancer.
If you block telomerase in certain kinds of cancer cells, you can actually stop those cancer cells from dividing.
More interviews with scientists at our website. I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the Moscow State Radio Symphony Orchestra on February 25th. More information on this and other events can be found at krannertcenter.com.
It's 3 minutes before 3 o'clock. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. 25 degrees in Urbana. We have overcast skies. Illinois is a long way from an ocean view, yet how often do we hear weather forecasters talk about weather systems moving in from the Pacific or the Gulf of Mexico? And we may find ourselves talking about the weather over a seafood dinner. Did you know, though, that the world's oceans are truly our life support system? They produce most of the oxygen we breathe. Tomorrow on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at the health of our oceans. Our guest at 106 will be oceanographer Sylvia Earle. She is the author of The World is Blue, How Our